Hello, I'm BJ Morgan, and in this podcast, I do a deep dive on The Woman King and try to explore some of the themes, histories, and conversations around the movie. Some things about me: I'm an enthusiast and a bit of a history buff. I like to talk about the art I find engaging and entertaining, stories that spark a conversation, send me searching for more information, and get me thinking. In terms of a critique, I might be a bit biased, because I did really enjoy this film. Just a warning, in these episodes, I am going to break open every part of The Woman King I can get into, so there will be spoilers. And with that, let's go!
From Toyin Falola and Matthew Heaton's A History of Nigeria, Cambridge University Press, 2008. The Oyo Empire, 1400 to 1830s, was a powerful Yoruba polity in what is today southwestern Nigeria. Situated in an ideal geographic location between the Volta and Niger River, the Oyo Empire became an important trade center. Its foundation myth draws upon Yoruba religious beliefs and holds sacred the original settlement of Ile Ife, which continues to be upheld as the creation site for the Yoruba people, with significance to local religious practitioners, as well as members of African-derived religions outside of Nigeria. Increased trade with European colonial powers, internal strife, which provided a constant stream of captives to be sold to Europeans, to fuel the transatlantic slave trade, a weakened army, and the growth of Islamic expansionist movements led to the collapse of the Oyo Empire. Back at the palace of Abome, Amenza arrives in Aniska's rooms and realizes the general is preparing to defy the king's orders and leave to try and rescue Nawi. Naniska reveals to Amenza that the beast from her dreams is her. "It is the girl who was silenced in those shackles by those men," she says. "I have hidden her away. I have denied her pain. But I'm going to hear her now." Such a powerful delivery from Viola Davis. The two have an emotional parting, and Amenza watches her go. As Naniska walks out of the palace gates, she crosses the Migan and some of his men. He gives her a questioning look, as if he suspects she's going on a one-man mission against the king's orders. But he continues in and says nothing. Naniska grips the shark's teeth on her necklace. She steels herself and starts running away from the fires and the light of the palace and the village, and into the night. The next scene is just another powerful sequence. I mean, this movie just keeps them coming. It starts just at the break of dawn. A powerful a cappella chorus pounds to the rhythm of Naniska's footfalls as she runs alone. And then slowly coming into view behind her, we recognize Amenza's frame. And behind her is the Migan, and then another soldier, and another. Finally, we see just a stunning shot with Naniska, followed by a contingent of Dahomey's warriors, running across the African plain. It's very emotional as they run towards possible death, but perhaps more so, because their choice is in direct defiance of the king. We now see Nawi in a room sitting on the floor in the aftermath of events at Wida. Malik brings in clothes for her and tells her he plans to get her out at night, but she challenges him for locking her in. He tells her he's trying to protect her. He gives her the key, and you have the sense he's earnest, reminding her that a white man was killed and she is in danger. He tells her he wants to take her with him to England, and he has booked passage on a cargo ship. Back at the palace in Abomey, Tanonu and Shante tell the king that Naniska and other soldiers have left. Shante suggests that putting the planned feast on hold would make the king look weak. She's clearly gunning for the title of Pojito herself. In the port city of Wida, we see sailors and merchants having a jolly old time, drinking and carrying on. In the darkness, we see the warriors have silently crept up to the barracoon, and they take out the men guarding the captives. The captives are then armed with whatever they find, chains, all kinds of weapons and implements, and they follow the Agujie toward the city. They're spotted and shots are fired from buildings outside the city. Nawi rises from the bed with a start, rushing to get dressed. Malik comes in and he wants to help, but she tells him he must go, as she will join her sisters. Outside, the fighting has begun. Naniska tells the Migan that they will burn the trade to the ground. He holds a flaming torch to the auction block. It's a very powerful moment as the block goes up in flames. The fighting goes on, and Malik and Santo reach the beach, with Santo still trying to corral some captives he has in chains to boats so they can leave. But Malik stops him, untying the men. The men drown Santo in retaliation as Malik looks on. Elsewhere, Oba arrives and sees Naniska. He no longer commands an army, and as he charges towards her, she cuts down the horse and they begin to fight, this time in an intimately intense battle. At one point, she cuts off his earlobe, and the piercing that had caused her to recognize him after so many years is in her hands. She takes a lot of hits, and although he puts a blade in her forearm, she bests him in a harrowing scene.
You do not remember me. Now, you will never forget.
Just then, a European soldier aims his gun at Naniska. We hear a shot from behind that takes him down, and it is Nawi. She has exchanged her bloody and torn clothes for undergarments, a pair of white pantaloons and a vest from the clothes Malik brought her, keeping on her leather belt. She drops the gun and picks up a discarded sword, and single-handedly she takes down the remaining soldiers around Naniska. Again, in that deferential gesture, she gives her sword to Naniska, and they both survey the scene before Naniska calls out to the Agoche, and they slowly start to gather. We see Amenza, Tara, Okankan, Sindra, and the other warriors. Malik is urged by some of the men on the beach to leave on the waiting boats for safety. As the Dahomey warriors start to head inland, Malik stands on the beach, and at a distance, he and Nawi exchange a look, a nod, a smile. Maybe in another life, they could have something, but here she is Agoche, and she turns to go. It is coronation day, and the palace again is abuzz with activity. It's a colorful scene. There's dancing and drumming. We see Shante being fussed about by other wives. They all dressed ornately. Soldiers stand, men and women, on either side in front of the king. And behind the soldiers, the people are celebrating, and the courtyard is full, and the crowds spill outside the palace walls. The soldiers, however, look stern. After all, I think the knowledge that both their generals effectively went rogue must weigh on them. Gezo is there, and although the atmosphere is celebratory, you can sense the tension underneath the surface. The king glances over at Shante, and there's just a hint of concern there, but his face is otherwise inscrutable. The scene is really very well played by John Boyega. Then we see the crowd parting and the warriors return. The celebrating and dancing slowly turns into a chant. Naniska! Naniska! As the warriors make their way into the courtyard, we see Nawi's family. Her sister and brother are grinning and not even trying to look down as they should. Her father now bows his head and her mother looks happy. She sees her friend Dayo, who was with her when we first met Nawi, and Nawi smiles at them. As the warriors approach the throne, Shante looks anxious. Naniska stands in front of King Gezu, head bowed, her flattened sword extended toward him, ready to accept whatever fate awaits. He remarks that she disobeyed him, and she tells him she will resign her position. Then, Gezu takes the sword and ascends to his throne, faces the crowd, and gives a powerful speech.
We have ended the reign of the Oyo Empire. Yeah! Of the warriors. Look at them. Many never thought it possible, but we believed. That is what makes a great leader. Seeing what others do not. The Europeans and the Americans have seen if you want to hold a people in chains, one must first convince them that they are meant to be bound. We join them in becoming our own oppressor, but no more. No more. We are a warrior people, and there is power in our mind, in our unity, in our culture. If we understand that power, we will be limitless. My people, this is a vision I will lead. It is a vision that is shared. Heroes of Dahomey, behold, the bravest of the brave, appointed by King Gezo, elevated to the sacred title of Pochito, Naninska, the woman king.
Afterward, Naninska finds Nawi at the altar, pouring an offering of water for Izogi. She scoffs and produces a bottle of whiskey to offer instead. She gets down beside Nawi, and we see the girl is struggling with the realization of her parentage. "In my blood is the blood of a killer," she says. I like something that one of the normies said in their YouTube review of The Woman King. I think it was Chris. When Nawi says, "In my blood is the blood of a killer," he says, "Also the blood of a king." I just love that. Maybe it's obvious, but I love the juxtaposition there. And the two of them talk. Naninska tells Nawi she is sorry for not being brave enough. She says Nawi survived because she is meant to be there. It is not your fault what happened to me. You are not the thing that hurt me. You are Nawi. You are my daughter. Nawi still cannot accept this and says she is sorry and runs away. And in that moment, Naninska lets herself just break. In one of the final scenes of the film, we see an ongoing celebration within the palace, and the Agogie dressed in rich and vibrantly colored wrappers dance to the beat of drums as Naninska the Pochito looks on. She sits on her official stool, dressed in royal purple wrappers. Her body still bears the scars from battles, and we see the medicine in the cuts on her back. Nawi approaches. She leans in with a smile and asks, "Mother, will you dance?" The two of them have a tender moment as Naninska lays Nawi's head on her chest and holds her in an embrace. They join the others in a final wonderful display of the dancing and joy and the life that's infused throughout the film, and it's absolutely beautiful. The end scene is just epic. There's Amenza, Nawi, and Naninska standing together, overlooking a cliff on the coast, each of them holding their weapon over their shoulder, as they gaze out to sea. The port of Ouidah is on one side, and their ships out on the ocean. The blazing letters of the title card appear, and the Woman King theme just soars and crescendos. And then in a powerful post-credit scene, we see Amenza at the altar. She pours out libation over the weapons of the fallen sisters in blood. You fall, and now you rise.
Sisters in blood, you fall, and now you rise. Dance with us. Be with us. You live for me, and I for you. Izogi. Ode. Esi, Yoshi, Aleko, Kesia, Brionna.
My notes on the post-credit scene. As the names of fallen sisters are called out, the inclusion of a name from our time, Brionna, is a reminder of the unbroken chain of departures and returns. One example, in 2005, a Black woman from Charleston, South Carolina, made an historic homecoming visit to the West African nation of Sierra Leone. This from Yale's Gilda Lehrman Center for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition. Tomalin Martin Polite is a seventh generation descendant of Priscilla. a 10-year-old girl taken on the slave ship Hare from Sierra Leone to South Carolina in 1756. Very few can trace their family history for 250 years, but even fewer can identify a specific ancestor from Africa and know where in that vast continent he or she came from. Tomalin's homecoming is thus important for Sierra Leoneans, delighted to receive their long-lost kinsmen from America, and for Black Americans who will share in her joy at finding her ancestral home in Africa. And that's it from me on the film itself. I hope you enjoyed that review, overview, breaking open of the story. Please stick around. There's lots more to come. Credit my mega, take a trip to see Jamaica. Molly spirit with the vapor, back to Zion destination. Africa, the new America. I hope I earn this permanent. And this, I put my pen in, they got my land and my permit with it. Bone on my bone, flesh on my flesh. Witness in me, you can't make me feel less. Let's hold, I'm not impressed. Best mode, got my effort like an empress. Great state I'm in all states I'm in. I might find a form. The score. The soundtrack, released by Milan Records, features a score by Terence Blanchard. Their website describes the soundtrack as heavily influenced by the rich musical tradition of the West African region and includes vocal contributions from South African producer, composer, and singer Lebo M, who infuses the collection with an authentic and original sound. When recording the score, Blanchard also utilized a full orchestra and a choir of opera singers led by Ghanaian-American mezzo-soprano Tessia Kwarteng, a decision the composer said adds color, realness, and culture to this film. In interviews, Blanchard said the scene after the battle where they're coming back to the kingdom is where he started scoring the film. He talks about the beauty and the pageantry of this kingdom and how that set up everything else, so the music had to have a warm, familiar kind of resonance to it, and to feel like a neighborhood that anyone would want to be a part of, which so closely matches the visual experience I described earlier and the sort of genre art sense in which the Dahomey Kingdom and its various locations are depicted throughout this film. Five-time Grammy Award winner, jazz singer Diane Reeves contributes improvisational vocals to the film, with chorus playing a major role in the score. There are incredible vocal performances by actors Sheila Atim, Lashana Lynch and Adrian Warren, and artists Jabu Chirinda and Nokukanya Dlamini perform with the South African choir. The soundtrack is crowned with a rousing anthem, Keep Rising, adapted for the film by Jesse Wilson, who wrote and recorded the song originally with producer Jeremy Lotito. According to an interview Jesse Wilson gave NPR, director Gina Prince-Bythewood would ask to adapt two lyrics to the film's time period and feature legendary Beninois singer Angelique Kidjo. And of course, as I mentioned at the start, Blanchard won the 2022 Hollywood Music and Media Award for Best Original Score in a Feature Film. Cinematography. Polly Morgan, in talking about her goals for this film, describes how she tries to capture just the beauty of the landscape and lean into the colors of the environment, which could be a challenge for scenes taking place at night. In an interview for Cinematography World, Morgan said, "We wanted to create a beautiful yet authentic movie, staying true to historical fact, telling the story of the incredible Agodje women in a way that felt real, visceral, and raw, but not be overly glossy. We wanted to introduce a new vision of Africa, not as a dry and dusty place, but a rich, beautiful land that held this vast cultural kingdom of Dahomey, and to explore the reality of African light, the hard sun, the deep shadows, and the varying weather." I learned that whilst Gina loves shooting large format and handheld, her aim was to elevate the epic scope of the movie by harnessing a more fluid style of camera movement, and loves to use multiple cameras to get multiple angles at the same time in the action scenes. However, within this context, it was also important to focus on the relationships between our characters, and the phrase intimately epic kept coming up. When it came to portraiture, "We wanted to celebrate the beauty of Black faces," Morgan says, "lighting our characters to make them shine and show both their strength and vulnerability. Copious amounts of smoke and dust from the wind helped to create texture in the film, lifting the shadows and softening the contrast." This was Polly Morgan's first collaboration with director Gina Prince-Bythewood. Costume designer Gersha Phillips drew upon African tradition while creating outfits for the Woman King. During her research, Phillips discovered that Agogia warriors in West Africa wore baggy pants during that time. Initially, she designed outfits in that style, but several iterations later, she incorporated wrap skirts, also seen in historical archives. This from a Variety interview with Phillips. Since the women were going to be moving a lot, Phillips says, I had to consider functionality. Everyone had to fight, so we ended up using a stretch knit fabric so they could do what they needed to in it. Cowrie shells featured prominently in many of the costumes and headdress, armbands, belts, or pouches. General Naniska's designs were more elaborate, befitting her rank. The palace tunics had gold embroidery, but Naniska's had the most embroidery added in, Phillips says. Her look was elevated and always had extra detail. Young aspiring warrior Nawi, played by Tuso Mbedu, and other recruits, by contrast, wore a simple 2-yard piece of fabric that was wrapped around the body. The strip weave material was specially made by weavers from the Bolgatanga in Ghana. We had our fabric woven in 10-centimeter pieces, and it's all joined together to make what became the Agogia palace tunics. Side note, the shape of the tunics reminds me of the general design of tunics we wore, especially in high school in Sierra Leone in the 90s. I was there in the 90s, but the all-girls school I attended was established in 1849. I'd like to think the inspiration for our sports tunics was taken from the legend or just the fashion influences in the region at that time. The white fabric of the tunic in the movies was a traditionally woven cloth, which in Sierra Leone would be called country cloth, which is strip-woven cotton. The tunics we wore were made of regular calico cotton. According to Phillips, indigo block printing was also used on the costumes for the film. An artisan from Gambia named Musa ended up making them in his backyard. He would hand-dye traditional batik cotton before sending outfits to the Cape Town set. Join me for the final episode where I continue to explore themes, histories, and conversations related to this film. I'll go through a few other topics like spirituality and symbolism and traditional knowledge of plants and invertebrates used in medicine, magic, and religion in the context of the film and much more. That's next time. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.